in the White Album. Chapter 1, 1974. Theme. For the first time in his life, the words refuse to come. He lies in bed, propped on a pile of chintz pillows, their suffocating tangle of tea roses faintly reminiscent of a southern grandam's parlor. We've each mused, at one time or another, that somewhere beneath his gnarled gnome exterior lurks a genteel New Orleans matron, mortified by her host form's crassness. He stares vacantly at the page before him, thoughts elsewhere, on delivery dates he hasn't met, on advances already spent, on the Fabergé paperweight he's just nabbed at auction, how it changes hue when the light shines through it just so, citrine tones conjuring Babe's miniature vegetables, darling little carrots that only grow so big. On the 800 pages of lies he has or hasn't told, depending on who you ask, depending on what he said and to whom. For all his boasts to the contrary, the paper, curled around the barrel of the Smith Corona, balanced on his protuberant stomach, is barren. A stack of sunny legal pads proves equally unfruitful, his spider-like scrawl more scribbled through than not. He reaches for an ashtray full of half-smoked cigarettes and grabs his pack of Trues, a brand he's sworn to each of us had been named after him. He trembles as he lights one, causing the flame to quiver before he sucks the nicotine into his lungs. He runs a hand through his tissue-fine hair, a gesture of old when a mop of thick corn-silk fringe swept across his forehead. The fringe, like so much else, is long gone, with only a habitual gesture to remind us of the tow-haired boy we once adored, a boy pampered and indulged well into middle age, courtesy of his unquestioned genius. In madras pajamas and ratty pink cardigan, the aging wunderkind seems less the literary lion, less still the social barracuda of public perception. Alone in a darkened room, stripped of bravura, he looks like what he is, just a pissant rugrat from Monroeville, Alabama, shit-scared as ever. His phrase, not ours. The tiny terror is, in many ways, still the terrified toddler who sobbed when his mama left him locked in flea-bag motels while she stole out with her lovers. Lily May, who traded her small-town, small-time name for a more exotic Nina, a further removal from the role she never wanted, mother to the odd Lilliputian boy with the snow hair, toad face, and girlish voice, the child whose very oddness repulsed her. He'd sat, he's told us, on the big bed, chubby fingers sticky with sugar from the bag of beignets that had been bought to bribe his silence. He watched her dressing as he chewed, wide eyes peering from his cherub face. She was barely more than a girl herself, and were it not for his gnawing at the scrap of fried dough, one might mistake him for her baby doll, propped against the pillows, rather than her great mistake. A live baby who she never asked for, from whom she just needed a few hours' escape to try to salvage her wreck of a laugh. She told him this in dulcet tones, almost a lullaby, which he couldn't help but think of as good, given her smile as she cradled him close. She was beauty and light, his whole tiny universe. He'd study her as she sat at the vanity in a sheer black slip, taming a honeyed pin curl into place. He watched as she unscrewed a tube of lipstick, red like the tin fire engine a man called Daddy once gave him. She smacked a pout at her reflection. Across the room, he'd mimic the same, spreading a sticky sugar between invisible lips. She grinned at him, and he giggled. He pulled another beignet from his bag as she slithered into a silky dress, the green-gray hue of Spanish moss. She told him that was the name of the stuff that hung from the trees there, those spider arms blowing in the breeze that used to scare him, the rustle of which he had come to think of as home.